kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to episode number 64 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide podcast with me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Belshaw.
Good evening, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm on a mission not to say or this week.
Hello! So last week, for anyone listening, we had a little, our call dropped out after about 10 minutes. So we had to start re-recording, and Doug edited the snippet to remove the ums and ahs that both of us said.
So, yeah, I realise that both of us say and quite a lot, especially during the first part of the podcast. So if you listen back to episode 63, what you'll notice is that I might have missed one or two, but basically there's no ums or ers in the first 10 minutes or so of the podcast, because I meticulously went through in Audacity and removed them. And it's actually quite an easy thing to do. In fact, I'm just launching an audiobook right now, and I've been recording myself saying some stuff about productivity, etc., and I've gone back through and removed them there. And it's funny how you start recognizing the waveform of an or an er.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. So you have to get your wavelength signature up big enough to be able to just identify patterns.
Yeah, and you can zoom in and stuff. It's really interesting, actually.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Oh no. Right. Well, apparently, so if you listen to last week's episode, you'll see that we actually don't say and as much through the podcast once we've warmed up. It's just in the sort of beginning section, apparently, that we do this.
Yes.
There we go. Right. So what have you been up to this week, Doug?
Well, this week I haven't had very much paid kind of consultancy work. So what I've done is, and, you know, I have my wonderful wife behind me, supporting me all the way, forcing me to get money, etc. What I've done is I've put myself out there to get more writing gigs, and I've managed to get two writing gigs this week, which I'm very pleased about. The first is for a new technology blog called The Nastarian, which is from Nastar, a technology company who I hadn't heard of before, but they've just moved into kind of cloud business, and they have started a blog where they want to, you know, high quality technology related stuff. So I've just written something today on how to work, basically it's how to work openly and why working openly is good for a technology business and culture. Uh-huh. And the other one is, there's a, you might have seen this as a Medium post, it's called Nuco Shift, you might have seen it, and they are launching a new productivity blog called Getting Shift Done, which is puntastic. Yes. And they want, you know, quite short, rapid fire productivity, one takeaway kind of 300 to 500 word pieces, maybe about 5 short blog posts of those per week. And so I've just about 2 hours ago had a conversation about that. So looking good, really.
That fits in well with your audiobook as well, which is also about productivity, am I right?
Yes, that's right. So I'll kind of promote this a bit more as we go along. But when I wrote my Essential Elements of Digital Literacies ebook, the way that I wrote it was very iterative. So it started off very cheap, like £1, which is the same as I'm doing for this audiobook. And then it gets more expensive as I add more content up to the maximum. And the great thing about that is that people who like my work get it cheaply, and I get feedback on what's going on as I kind of create this book. So this particular audiobook, this Upping Your Game, A Practical Guide to Personal Productivity, I wrote a version one of this as an ebook and sold it, and it's now free, and that must have been 5-6 years ago when we still did EdTech Roundup. But I wanted to do it as an audiobook this time, and as I say in the introduction to it, which is free and available, and I'll put it in the show notes, the reason I wanted to do it as an audiobook was a couple of things. First, you know, I really enjoy doing this kind of stuff. I really enjoy our podcast. I wanted to boil down to the essentials from version one and add new things from what I'd learned over the last 5 or 6 years. But also, I recognize the fact that when you're listening to stuff, you can be doing things at the same time. It's not like you have to, like, rip your eyeballs away from doing something else to focus on an ebook. You can literally listen to it while you're commuting or whatever it is you're doing at the same time. So I wanted to put an audiobook form. I'll be sending this out. I think about 25 people responded to a tiny little note I put on my blog last week, and they've asked for updates, so I'll be sending that out, and you'll be able to buy for like £1 this week. And then as I add every chapter, it'll go up, and I think I've got it so that it'll be about £7 eventually. But the idea is that it's really distilled productivity advice, basically. So the first chapter is on sleep, which is a funny thing place to start, but you'll see why if you read.
And crowdsource editing as well, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, which sounds a bit cheeky, but actually you realize that some people really focus in on typos, for example, or little slips of the tongue, or you said the wrong word or whatever it is. And other people have more meta level advice, and it's just great.
Cool. Well, I was doing, interestingly, and not unrelated, I was doing a digital induction for our first and second form tonight, which is year 7 and year 8, which is 11 to 13 years old, or 11 and 12, really. And I asked them, what question did I ask them? Something to do with social media accounts, I think. And I can't remember what it was, but I asked, there were three parts to the question, like yes, no, or somewhere in the middle. And a third of them put their hands up for each one, from which I deduced you can't please all of the people all of the time. So that's why a crowdsourced editing is really nice, because it allows you to kind of have these multiple filters going on, and you get feedback from different perspectives, which is like the hardest thing to do is design things for human beings, because everyone has different things going on, different priorities and agendas and things.
I think that's why working openly, this is one of the things I've mentioned in that working openly post, you never really know where the feedback's going to come from. I think I've mentioned this before on this podcast, but I would have pretty much failed my thesis defense had a blog post I wrote about my thesis not been ripped apart by a German professor a few months before I handed my thesis. And there's no way I could have sought out that kind of feedback. Like, he gave me very specific feedback on, like, post-structuralism. And he must have just stumbled across that, or someone referred him to it, or whatever. And if that hadn't been out in the open, how would I have got that feedback? It's a similar kind of thing on our Slack channel. We put stuff out there. We put a link. Sometimes I put it on Twitter of things I'm going to publish in future. And people, out of the goodness of their own heart, sometimes it's stuff I'm getting paid to write. People will say, could you expand on this a bit, or whatever. Ian O'Byrne does this quite a lot, actually. Hi, Ian, if you're listening. He's commented on this thing today, which I stuck in the Slack channel. And the thing I've realized for him, and I do the same when I comment on his stuff, is that if you help perfect, or if you help make something of someone else's better, the great upside for you is you can then link to that other person's stuff, which is reflecting the thoughts, your own thoughts. So let's say in your situation, Di, and I've been in this situation in an organization as well, you need to persuade people within your school to do something, and people will listen to you up to a certain degree. But then if you can point to something outside of your school and say, and this person thinks it's a good idea too, like, obviously people are more likely to listen. So I think there's a two-way relationship there when it comes to helping other people giving feedback to help make other people's stuff better.
Yes, I think it's absolutely a mutually beneficial thing, isn't it? Absolutely. So I was giving this presentation earlier today for an hour to these young children, and I thought I'd done like a really good job. I'd thought about it and what I was doing, and I showed them a bit of Shift Happens, gave them some stats and things, and talked about essentially trying to keep an open mind to technology, and I talked through the digital services that we offer at the school, and I talked through about being safe online. I asked them how many of them had social media accounts, although they're all underage, and about half of them did. And so we talked about that and how they would post and all that kind of thing. And I was really, we talked about screen time and looking after themselves. And I talked, I was all about, like, I want you to listen to yourselves and to take action if something doesn't feel right. If you feel like you're getting too tired and you're unable to cope with your obligatory day sort of thing, your day at school and your work and all of that, then you need to take action if you know that you're reading your phone after lights out or whatever it might be. And not that they do that in school, because they don't have their phones on them if they're in a boarding house, but some of them are day pupils. And
so hang on, if they're in the boarding house, what happens?
Their phones, they get their phones for a certain amount of time.
Oh, I see, then they have to hand them in.
And they have to hand them in, yeah, so everyone's phone is named and whatever. And anyway, so I was telling them this, and I thought I was taking a really sort of positive attitude towards it and all of that. And And I included this video that Amy Burville had shared with me, actually, called Power to Create by Matthew Taylor from the RSA, and which is really, really interesting and is going to segue into where we're going. And it was kind of, but the idea was being, so it's not a video for children at all, but I thought it was good to give them some adult sort of content, not adult rated content, but adult intended content.
Give them filth.
Didn't do that. Anyway, and I thought I'd done a really good job. Anyway, my housemaster's son was in the audience, and I saw my housemaster afterwards, who had seen his son since I'd done that. And I said, "Oh, did he enjoy it?" He said, "I asked him what he learned. He said he didn't learn much."
Yeah, but kids are like that, you know. Like, no kid wants to be told by some 40-odd-year-old bloke how to use technology. Especially when it's something like social media and smartphones.
Oh, no, but that is my job.
No. Right, but what I'm saying is you shouldn't, I would say, that you shouldn't assume that they'll ever admit to you having taught them anything.
Well, yes, but I'll check, because I teach 20 odd of them, so I will check with them what they thought about it and whether they found it useful or not. This particular individual doesn't use social media at all, so he didn't find that part of it relevant. But I'd have thought there'd have been other stuff they'd have found really interesting in it, but he didn't anyway. So I put a link into the Power to Create video, which is like a 5-minute animation and well worth a watch if you haven't seen it, and it goes on to talk about society in a way that I think you and I in this podcast talk about society quite a lot, as in where we think it can be. So Matthew Taylor talks about the opportunity that is there for the flattening of the world effectively through the internet, and that these are really creative times, that you know, people want to be creative, being creative, and creativity is very much something that's talked about and desired by organizations, institutions, individuals, and society at large, communities, you know, and how this can pull communities together and that kind of thing. So I thought it was really relevant for these young people to see this, because I was trying to say to them, use the technology in a really positive way to have fun and to be creative, and to kind of balance the world out in a little way. And so that's that. And
have
we're
you
going
seen
to
the RSA. Did I talk about this last week? The RSA have got this thing called a place for learning. No?
No.
So, you know, we've talked about cities of learning and kind of badge pathways and all that kind of stuff in like Chicago, etc. before. So, the team I was on at Mozilla did this project. You know, basically everyone on that team, apart from me, because I was in the UK, ended up in Chicago running this first Badges Across Cities pilot in 2013. And it was massively successful. And the MacArthur Foundation ended up spinning out a non-profit called Collective Shift, which has a program called LRNG. And they're now working all over the US, connecting cities together with badges and pathways, and they've got a platform, etc. Well, I went to an event at the RSA earlier this year with Brian Mathers and Digital Me were there, etc., and I know Digital Me are helping the RSA. And it looks like, although they haven't ruled out their LRNG platform, it looks like that what they want to do is something maybe a bit more UK-flavored, a bit more organic, I'm not sure. But what they have done is this, they've got a Medium publication, the RSA, called A Place for Learning, Putting Learning at the Heart of Citizenship, Civic Identity, and Community Life. And they've written this kind of paper for this imaginary city or town called Kensalfield. And they're imagining what a city of learning would look like in Kensalfield. Now, the actual memorandum, proposal, whatever, only mentioned badges once, but the whole thing really has open badges and new forms of credentialing, new forms of thinking of joining up a city in terms of learning, running all the way through it. So for anyone interested in this kind of stuff, they've done a great job, and it's a great jumping off point for some of the work which I think is going to be happening in future. And we are open, the co-op that Brian, John, Laura, and I have set up. We're going to be doing some work with the City of Sunderland, starting at the start of next month. Hopefully there'll be a pilot in the City of Sunderland the start of next year for this kind of thing. So it's exciting times, because I think that what badges do especially, and we'll talk about that later on, is they provide local ecosystems of value which work on a global level because of the open metadata standard.
Okay, I think we have looked at this before, actually, when you, it must be when you went to the event.
Right. Well, this has only just been published last week.
Oh, okay, so this is new, but the principle isn't.
Yeah.
That looks interesting.
Mm.
Completely unrelated to the content, but the city analogy I used in my learning in my lessons this week when describing, so we were looking at how a CPU is made, how a processor is made, from sand and it's all the way through production kind of thing with silicon wafers and how light is used to do all the crazy crap. So there are billions of transistors within a silicon, within a processor. So looking at the motherboard in particular and understanding it, my analogy for the motherboard was a city skyline, effectively. So it's just like London, for example, where you have your...
Like your Tron Legacy.
Yeah, you have like your big features and the Gherkin and the Shard and Big Ben and whatever. And then you have all the roads and the houses and the things where all the real stuff is going on. But it kind of all works together somehow.
That's a good analogy. Yeah. Someone on Twitter put, I don't know how true this is, but it said that the mobile or the processor that led to all of the mobile processors in phones and smart devices and stuff was invented, because it's Ada Lovelace Day today, isn't it? Was invented by a transgender woman.
All right. Okay.
So there you go.
Interesting. I also watched, we watched this video on mobile processors as well.
Right.
And there was this gentleman discussing the demands that are made upon a square millimeter of silicon and how they're budgeting it and the sort of margins that are being made prior to like 500 million of these chips being processed to go into different handsets and whatever. And the sort of budgets that he has to deal with, etc., and the negotiation process, which is real hard-nosed negotiating, he said. When you're balancing, for example, what comes up on your screen for your user interface, and then what comes up with a 3D gaming app, are very, very different uses of the GPU and the CPU, and how they sort of negotiate the difference between the hardware that's going to go inside the device and the sort of real estate that they have to play with, and the amount of budget they have to go away and recode stuff to improve its performance. Interesting. It was quite clear that there was a massive commercial engine at work, and that is pretty much what's advancing technology at the rate that it's still advancing at. You know, that's one of the big catalysts of development, I guess.
I was talking to Jeff Stead, who you might have heard of. He used to work in Tribal, then he worked at Qualcomm. And then he's now at Cambridge English, and he's had me in there to do some badges work. I'll be going back in December to do some more work with Cambridge English and Cambridge Assessment. But he was talking about some of the lavishness at Qualcomm and some of the stories which he told me, which I can tell you offline, I guess. But some interesting times. Limos in Vegas.
Okay, nice stories. Maybe over a beer sometime, that'd be nice.
Good stuff. Okay, one of the things I wanted to mention, because I wondered if you'd given it any thought, Di, was there was a thing going around on Twitter, and what it was asking, it was called My Creative Commons Superheroes, and the idea was you mentioned five people, which you could, and most people were doing in the space of a tweet, saying, who are your superheroes of Creative Commons? So people who work openly, who use Creative Commons licenses. And I wanted to celebrate this fact, and I wanted to use more than just a tweet to do it. So I wrote a blog post last week, and this is part of the Creative Commons certification project that We Are Open has been involved with, done a thinkathon, etc. And so I chose five people, and I wondered, before I say who my five were, if you'd given that any thought?
I've given it no thought whatsoever.
Right.
Is that okay to say that?
That's fine. Yeah, you
might not have seen it. So I don't really have... I like the idea of Creative Commons. I find Creative Commons is always, it's really difficult when working with young people to push the idea of copyright for different reasons. One is that their uses are educational only. And the other is that it's really hard to change their working practices on a very basic level. So, for example, what do I mean by that? Children do not type in my experience, do not type URLs directly into the address bar. they will always, so they don't understand that address bars are search engines of their own, or a route to a search engine. And they go to the search engine, then they search for something. So, for example, our URL for our intranet is portal.oundleschool.org.uk. They will type Oundle School into a search engine. Then they will navigate to the, which is about two or three clicks, to the portal section, and they will access it via that, rather than just remembering portal.outlawschool.org.uk, which once you've done it on your browser on one machine, will remain on that machine.
Yeah, but I think that's an artifact of, I don't know, the way that we've been brought up. So, for example, if you reimagine that as a process or workflow that is the spoken word rather than having to type something in, it makes perfect sense to say, like, okay, Google, please, you know, like, search Oundle School portal and then just clicking on the top link.
Yes, no, absolutely. Although it's much less ergonomic. It takes longer.
Well, possibly. I can see a reason for it. I tell you something which I've noticed more and more recently, even just there when I was searching for the link for the RSA thing. So what did I type in to Chrome? I typed in medium.com and then RSA. And when I typed in medium.com, it automatically turned into the search engine for medium.com. You see what I mean? And in the same way that like anything which has a search engine built in, like WordPress or any website which is fairly search heavy these days, you don't even have to go to Google first. It turns into the search engine for that website in your browser bar.
So that, as in, so Google do that? Obviously. That's a Google trick, surely.
Well, it must be, but there must be a way in which you can code your website to take advantage of that, which is why I was trying to think a couple of steps ahead in terms of, could you code your school website so that when someone typed in Oundle School, the next thing that they typed would automatically search your school website?
I don't know, because when I type medium.com in and then space, it doesn't turn into a search engine. It just is Google.
Right. Well, have a go in Chrome. Type in like medium.com and then some kind of search term. Yeah, it totally works. You don't have to do it now, but...
I just did. That's what I'm saying to you. I typed in medium space RSA.
No, medium.com.
Yeah, sorry, medium.com space RSA. And then
it just
does that. I press enter and it gives me the Google results at the bottom. So
if I type in medium, this is fascinating audio.
Do it yourselves and then you'll see. Any well updated Chrome browser will do.
Yeah. Well, maybe, I mean, this another thing is I've got so many extensions active. Who knows? It might be one of those.
Could be.
It could be like Disconnect Me or anything like that. Probably is Disconnect Me. Anyway, back on track. So the Creative Commons superhero idea, I thought I have to respond to this. So the people I chose are definitely worth following. I'm sure you follow all these people, Di, but some people listening may not have heard of some of these people. So let me just go through them. Alan Levine, who is CogDog, CogDogBlog.com. Alan, I have known online for over 10 years, I would say. And I've met maybe once, twice in person. I met him at the Mozilla Festival a couple of years ago. Great guy. Such a generous person in terms of his time and talent and that kind of thing. So, yeah, an inspiration to me. Audrey Waters, for anybody who listens to this podcast, including Audrey, hello, will be unsurprised that I chose her. And I said how she's a tireless advocate of all things open, especially in education technology. An important critic of the Silicon Valley narrative and someone who tolerates bullshit less than anyone I've ever known. And then Cory Doctorow, I've only met Cory a couple of times, including one time when I was introduced to him at Maker Faire about 4 years ago. And I thought, oh, he seems familiar for some reason, totally out of context. And looked at his shoes and thought, I'm sure I've come across somebody or know somebody who has crazy shoes like that. And then realized about 2 minutes later it was Cory Doctorow. And I was so mortified I couldn't go back and like reintroduce myself to him. But I've spoken to him since then. Then Jess Klein, who I worked with at Mozilla, who is on our Slack channel, Di, and
she
if
is.
You Hello, ever Jess. Get the chance to work with her, is so talented, it's unbelievable.
I'd second that. I've kind of just done little bits with Jess, just helping her out with stuff she's doing, and just commenting on things. Nothing large, but she does wear her work on her sleeve, and it's in a kind of open way. It's really, really good. It's interesting to see.
Google Photos popped up today with, you know, those things that says, "Oh, 5 years ago today." And 5 years ago today, I was in New York at Mobility Shifts. I was working for JISC at the time. This was the conference that I got to go to because I put a tweet out saying, "Hey, I wonder if anyone would sponsor me to go to this thing." And someone did, and paid like $10,000. And all I had to do in return was to blog each day on his, you know, post each day on his blog about the event because he couldn't make it. That was Scott McLeod, who was at the time at the Center for Advanced Studies of School Leadership and Education, which is known as CASEL as an acronym. And I met Jess, and she was just about to join Mozilla. I was volunteering for Mozilla at the time, and I met Kathy Davidson, all that kind of stuff. And just, I remember Jess was just in her element running this workshop, and it was great. And at that thing, I also met Jim Groom, and the picture, the photo that popped up of him was us in this completely wood-paneled pizza restaurant with Joss Wynn, Michael Gervovich, as he called, and some other people eating pizza, and Jim, of course, holding court as he does, talking to everyone and entertaining people. So, yeah, some very inspirational people on that list, and I could have gone on and on and on, including the people that I work with all the time, like Brian and Laura and John. That would have been cheating. So I mentioned those five, and yeah, if anyone's listening, and I think the idea is still going, if you've got some Creative Commons superheroes, do write something about them, do tweet about them.
I think it's a good idea to recognize the people who share their stuff and work openly and that are an inspiration to you in one way or another, you know? It's nice. I'll have a think about it.
Well, there used to be these kinds of chains of blog posts back in the day before social networking was such a big thing. You know, someone would tag three people and they'd respond, and it was a bit homely and a bit, you know, but that's the way the web worked.
Back in the good old days.
Yes, the golden age of the web before all these
all right, got hold of it. Let's get to business. What are we here to talk about?
We're talking about meritocracy, something which we were going to talk about last week, but now my post has actually been published on DML Central, and the title of this is Why It's Time to Let Go of quote-unquote meritocracy. And you've read this, and
I have
tried to make it into as concise a post as possible, and so what I wanted to do was just to discuss whether it's something which makes sense, what you think about it, and perhaps just unpack it a bit.
I think it's worth unpacking. It's a nice idea. So if we just give it a framework in the first instance, Theresa May has recently come out, the Prime Minister of the UK now, has recently come out and said, sorry, I'm just noting my own arm there.
Keep humming, by all means.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it. She said grammar schools, let's do grammar schools because meritocratic education system or meritocratic society is what we aspire to. That's our goal. So I guess what we need to do now is define meritocratic. And since you wrote the post, you can do that.
Well, the thing which, you know how ideas come together and coalesce over time. I have children in UK state schools. And if the grammar school system was brought in, then my son would probably be one of the first kids to sit the 11 plus, because he's 9 at the moment. And he would probably get into grammar school. In fact, I'm almost certain he would. And my daughter would sail through, because we're reading Matilda at the moment, and the parallels are scary. So it's not that I'm critiquing the grammar school system from it not being a good system for my kids. A bit like you, Di. Like, your kids, Oxford, educated, very, come from, you know, clever parents, intelligent kids themselves, very well-rounded, etc. The critique here comes from wanting a fairer, more just society. And my critique here comes from, I think, a misunderstanding of what meritocracy is. And it was kind of prompted by something that Oliver Quinlan said in his newsletter maybe about a month ago. And I think we mentioned it on here about how what Theresa May is talking about and other conservative politicians is that if you're hardworking, then you'll be almost given a golden ticket to join the elite and everyone else can just get lost and starve and suffer. So what I'm trying to get at here is that the fundamental premise that grammar schools are based on is one of meritocracy, which we haven't really as a society examined, and it sounds like a good thing, but it's actually deeply flawed. That's what I'm trying to get at.
It is, and yeah, I think you get at it well, and you do it through two main tacts. Tacts, is that a word? I think I just made that up.
Yes, so the first one is that actually the word meritocracy was introduced as a negative term. An essay by a guy called Michael Young in 1958, he imagined this kind of dystopian, stratified, technocratic world in the year 2033, which had been created because of this tripartite system where you had, what was it, grammar schools, secondary modern, and technical schools, is that right?
Sounds right, yeah.
I think in the events there weren't many technical schools built, so you ended up really with a system of, you know, middle-class kids going to grammar schools and most working-class kids going to secondary modern. So you had this stratified society, and it imagined that meritocracy had got us there. And it was critiquing that. But by the 1970s, meritocracy had been adopted, the language of meritocracy had been adopted by the conservatives as this is how we get the brightest and the best. You know, literally flipping it on its head. And at the same time, the Labour government wanted the opposite of that. They wanted a grammar school education for everyone. But, of course, then you had Margaret Thatcher getting in, and then, you know, it was very difficult. So I'm trying to say that actually where meritocracy comes from as a word doesn't mean that it's a good thing. And then I guess the second thing, given that we're unlikely to be able to recapture the original meaning of meritocracy, you know, you can't really go back and say, oh, actually, it means this, because it's already got a common meaning.
Mm-hmm. Ambiguity has changed it.
Yeah, exactly. It's now this dead metaphor where, you know, it doesn't really have any explanatory power. People just use it as something which they think they know what it means, but actually when you dig a bit deeper, it's a very problematic concept. The other thing that I think is problematic is that we think that meritocracy leads to the brightest and the best in society getting to the top, but even judging it by its own standards, even if we put aside the problematic approach of, you know, of meritocracy, it doesn't even work on its own terms, because what it's trying to do is to get the brightest and the best, but it's applying a filter which is made by the people who are already in power. So all it does is perpetuate and privilege those who are of a similar background and mindset to the people who are in power. So you don't get any progress. You just get a replication of the existing status quo, would be my argument.
And it's a fair one, I think. I think there's a problem here between trends in society and aspiration toward a more fair and equitable society and individuals' personal experience and their own family. So I adjudicated a couple of debates last week at our school, one on prisoners being allowed to elect for suicide after 5 years of imprisonment if they're life in prison, and the other one on whether torture is ever okay or not. So the House proposed that that torture was never okay, and it was opposed by there being extreme circumstances in which torture was okay. And in the latter debate, I had to do my contribution, which was about the torture one. And the last thing I said, it was, so I was not so torture has proven not to work. And there are very, very rare examples of where information has been gathered through torture that have led to any different outcome in terrorist situations or terror situations.
Yeah, because if someone's being waterboarded, they'll say whatever you want to stop being waterboarded.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. You just don't get the info that you need through torture. And this is from CIA investigation papers. It was, I can't remember the book that was cited. But I said at the end that and I was sort of looking to save the opposition a little bit. But I said I don't really see that torture is necessary and blah blah blah. But I thought that if it came down to a situation where one person stood between me and the safety of my loved ones, I said I hope that I would be an implementer of pain on that person to make sure that my loved ones were okay, which I thought was really what I was trying to get at is that people are not one thing. One person is not one thing. They think different things. So everyone knows someone who's been, I know people who've been through the grammar school system and it's been very successful for them. And I know many people who've been through the grammar school system and it's not been particularly successful for them. You know, I imagine they would have done well either way, which is probably a more important example for what we're talking about. But I know people who have gone on to do very great things and ended up being professors and such like, and they've done it through the grammar school system and come from an incredibly meager socioeconomic background.
Mm. But that's the thing. You can never prove a negative. And most of the arguments, and I'm only using the grammar school system as an example here of meritocracy, but most of the arguments come from anecdote rather than what's good for society or data or anything.
And then evidence, isn't there? There's a whole thing about when the grammar school system was first brought in, and I think it was in the 70s, lots of research was done into it, and all that research has been debunked. It's completely flawed. But it was saying that grammar schools are great, and they're not. The research methods used were appalling. So there doesn't actually exist anything but what we call selective common sense, if such a thing exists, that people are just saying anecdotally, this makes sense. You do this, you get this leg up at 11, it puts you into a system that's going to provide you with a better education and better qualifications, which gives you a leg up to the higher rungs of the ladder kind of concept. And that's really what it's saying. But bringing that back down to anecdotal is really what it is. You know, everyone knows someone who has. Hmm. But when you think about the number of people you know that have been to grammar school that don't seem to have actually done any better for the fact that they have. So I have my cousins went to grammar school in Ripon, who are the same age as me, and they haven't gone on and done any better than I have. I went to a comprehensive school in Middlesbrough.
I mean, this is the other thing as well. What counts as better as well?
Well, that's a huge thing.
Because, you know, if you hear the phrase, oh, such and such has got a good job, depending on the situation, I do like to push back on that, because good is always a euphemism for a well-paying job. And so,
I think it is. I mean, it'd be interesting if we sat down and, you know, drank a bottle of whiskey discussing what that meant, because, you know, so we'd have to at some point pull that into a contextual line. So outside of London, this means that you earn £35,000 per annum before tax, or more or less. You know, we could actually pull that somewhere by doing creating an algorithm of the standard of living and the different things that your I was just going to say average person, but we know there is no such thing as average. But do you know what I mean? It's like you think about the things that people do, so car, house, car, holiday bills, clothing, food, etc. And you could kind of pull a line out about, so you'd have to assume that when we talk about good life, what we mean is provision of the important characteristics of what society have decided is important, which would include...
So when I talk to my grandmother, for example, TV. You know, there would be... She wouldn't bat an eyelid to say in the same sentence, such and such has got a good job, but it means that he's away from his family all the time. Like, those two things are you know, are entirely congruent to her. Like, you can have a good job, which takes you away from your family all the time. Which, to me, like, those two things are polar opposites. Like, how could you have a good job where it takes you away from the people that you love most of the week? Like, that doesn't even make any sense to me. So I think part of it's generational and part of it's shifting of society, which is why I think it's really interesting when it comes to meritocracy. If you talk to, and I've seen research done in the UK generally, and especially in poorer areas, people are looking, you know, young people want to be rich and famous and win the lottery or become celebrities or footballers. And I know there's an element of that in all youth, and there will be at your school as well, Di. But it's almost like that's the only way to get out of the situation you're in. Like, the, like, having something bestowed upon you, which is like the grammar school system, or, you know, being plucked out of obscurity so that you don't have to deal with all that kind of stuff. I think I mentioned about the Monty Python sketch last week, didn't I, about, you know, all the peasants there grubbing about in the mud and saying, oh, that he must be a king, King Arthur going past. Why? He's not covered in shit. You know, so trying to get out of the situation and trying to, like, kick everyone else off the ladder while you're trying to climb up it does not seem like a good way of running a society.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I just want to touch on the point you said about the children in my school. A lot of the children in my school are looking for a means to sustain their lives. They're not on inherited money kind of thing, but their parents are wealthy. And they're looking, just in the same way, for a shortcut to keep themselves in the manner to which they become accustomed, rather than to aspire out of one situation to another. And I think it's quite... I remember when I was 17 years old, I went to visit a friend of mine from school called Stuart Purdy, I believe. I haven't seen him since school finished. His mum said to me, we were sitting having a cup of tea, and he'd gone off somewhere else in the house. And his mum said, well, one thing I'd say, she said, I'd never get stuck in the rat race. She said to me, just never get, you know, don't get into the idea of a mortgage.
You said that before, yeah.
And it's like, and it's sort of something that stuck with me, because it was a real contrast to what my own family would have said to me. And who would have jumped on board with the rat race kind of thing, and I'm not judging one way or the other, but to me as a 17-year-old, it was sort of interesting to hear an adult speak like that, because generally they didn't. That, you know, there were only like 3 or 4 TV channels at the time, and you just didn't hear much talk of any alternative to society other than the, you know, 2.4 nuclear family that was presented around you in suburbia. And I think that's an important thing. So it was quite interesting looking at, I remember seeing things like The Good Life with Richard Briers and Felicity Kendall, which was a TV sitcom about an accountant who had dumped his job and was going to live self-sustainable life. With chickens and pigs and...
Where they turned their garden into allotment and stuff, even though it was in normal suburbia.
So they lived in what society would deem as a sort of poverty situation, but actually they were all about finding happiness in their day-to-day routine with each other and the things that they were doing to live. And that was very striking at the time in the 1980s. A great contrast to how society was developing at that time under Margaret Thatcher, and a very capitalist emergent culture of greed and flashy showing off of your fast cars and your.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? Like, everybody is told these days. Dear me, I'm sounding old as I say this, but everyone is told that you can reach the highest highs of this society. And all you need to do is to go into competition against everybody else. And we have objective tests. Look at these examinations that everybody takes. And all you need to do is do well on these tests. And you can get right to the top. But of course, there's a wonderful image by, you know, Brian Mathers, which shows the football pitch at a massive angle. You know, some people are kicking up a 45-degree slope, and other people are kicking down it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't see how, because it's not a physical thing that you can see, because it's a construct, it's a thing in society, you can't see how biased these things are against you. And so you still do the rat in the barrel, grubbing about, competing against other people, but you don't realize that you're never going to get out the barrel. Or if you do, then the rest of them aren't getting out with you.
Yes, exactly. You have to tread on others to get out, and then they won't be able to. I think it's interesting, because the role of government, the role of Theresa May's government or any government of the day, is to balance that pitch. Is essentially it, isn't it? So I don't think society is ever going to be able to conduct itself in such a way that all is even and fair. But I think the role of a government is to balance the pitch, not to make it more slopey. Not to increase.
No, exactly. And there's a book called The Spirit Level, isn't there, which talks about how the even, you know, when it comes to, I think, like GDP and any kind of outcomes, the smaller the gap between the richest and the poorest in society, the better and more and the happier are nations overall.
And I think this is alignable to schools as well. So in schools like the one I teach in, Oxbridge results, and I'm sure in many other schools as well, Oxbridge results are talked about with, you know, when they're good, they're celebrated highly. So they should be. So achievement should be celebrated. But there's always a feeling in sort of academic meetings that, and this is not this school in particular, but different schools that I've worked in, that the Oxbridge clientele, the children applying for that, get much more consideration, much more resources put behind them, etc., preparing them for interview and application, and than do the other sort of 90, 80, 70% of the cohort who are not applying to Oxford.
Well, it's people responding to incentives. I've been in schools where if you were a kid who was predicted a D at GCSE, you know, this is before value added, this is before, you know, just on raw results. It'll be the same with Progress 8 now. But if you were a kid who was predicted a D and they thought you could get a C, you had resources ploughed into you. Whereas if you were a kid on an E or an F predicted, then, well, tough.
Yeah, no, this is it. And you wouldn't have resources put into you. But then again, you see, measures needed. And so one of the things that strikes me about the Oxbridge measurement or whatever is that everybody subscribes to the idea that getting into Oxbridge is good. No one says getting into Oxbridge is bad. You know you're going in a race, it's very selective, and there are only going to be so many people who cross the line. And so when Oxbridge applicants are successful, it is a very celebrated thing, and it's hard to say not, but what it is easy to say, but people don't seem to say much except quietly in a corner maybe, is that we're not addressing our focus toward the spread of our cohort, and it's bias, and it's bias towards that very high achievement. And I think did I mention it last week? I saw some article about the number of Oxbridge graduates or Oxbridge professors, Oxford it was, not Oxbridge, who are suffering from
depression.
High levels of depression and mental illness, which is interesting, you know.
I think this is the really poor advice that young, well, is it poor advice? Because really the job market is a lot about signaling. And yeah, it's interesting. When you've got things which have a strong signal, you're very aware that just how strong that signal is. So I've mentioned before, for me, it's the fact that for some people that I'm a doctor, it's like, oh, right, that's quite a strong signal. And that I've worked for Mozilla, for example. You know, one's a brand, one's a qualification. But they both, you've had to pass through a filter to get to that point. So it's used as a proxy for the type of person that they think that you are. And as we've talked many times before, this is one of the reasons why I think open badges are so great, because if we can dismantle that quite elitist, quite difficult to peer into black box of chunky triggers or chunky proxies for things, then I think the more, the fairer and more equitable society will be.
I think so, isn't it? It's about priorities. I wonder, Doug, I wonder about mental health. So the increase in awareness of mental health over the last 5 years has been considerable. And it's much more talked about, and it's, and many more resources being put into it, and it's been taken more seriously as a medical condition, etc. I wonder if in 10 years time, or even longer, 20 years time, that will have had an impact on society. So I think part of the key to mental health is unlocking, is being kinder generally to oneself and to, and you know, doing the things.
I think we're already starting to see this kind of stuff. So for example, if you, and excuse the language here, listeners, I can distinctly remember David Gower on A Question of Sport when I was about 15. Someone said, "Oh, you must be feeling the right twat now." And he said, "Oh, I wish I was." And this is on TV at 9 o'clock at night. And yeah. I'm thinking, what are you saying? And that's just the kind of sexist banter which was just normal, you know, in mainstream culture. Yet now you have Donald Trump saying stuff which I think it is outrageous, but not very long ago it wouldn't have been seen as a, you know, a reason to halt his campaign or anything. It would have just been like, well, this is what men say kind of thing. And I think we're getting that about sexism. We're getting to some extent about ageism. We're getting it about mental health issues, like people saying, oh, I'm a little bit OCD, which is, and oh, this person's really schizophrenic.
Or autism is talked about as well in, on, on a spectrum.
So I think
like
we're getting to a
spectrum.
Stage where, and it's always going to be pockets which become bigger, etc., until you get to a tipping point where, well, like gay marriage, for example, it seemed to almost come out of nowhere, and then all of a sudden everyone goes, oh, right, well, that's not a problem anymore, is it? And then everyone just gets on with it. It seems like that kind of situation.
Yes, but I just wonder how that will manifest itself once once it's been washed through a few cycles of changes in position, you know, generation, I guess, is really what I'm talking about, is that whether it will actually lead to people understanding what good life is more, you know, exercise, good food, and all of that, or whether I just live in a middle-class bubble and have no perception of what the real world is.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, if you think about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, once you get towards the top of that hierarchy, then you can start thinking about, you know, things which actually do matter to society. But I think it was the last week we talked about, yeah, it was last week, wasn't it, when we were talking about 1945 or 1944, 18-year-olds go and storm the battlefields in Normandy.
Yes.
You know, 2016, young people want safe spaces because it might hurt their feelings. Like, the whole point is we want to move up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We want things like a basic income for people so that they have their basic needs met. So we can start worrying about things which, yeah, don't matter when people haven't got places to sleep or enough food to eat or enough money. But we do want to focus on the higher order stuff because it shows that we're making progress as a society. And I feel like, going back to the meritocracy thing, the more that we're randomly picking poor kids out, poor but bright kids out, and saying, well, look, our system's fair because some of them get to the top, is entirely missing the point.
I agree. And I think it's, I mean, if you look at the research that went into the implementation of the comprehensive system, the research is pretty robust about how it is beneficial and it is the right thing to do. And I work in a school which stands in the face of the, you know, gets in the way of the comprehensive system actually being effective because it potentially detracts so many resources away from the real issue of the education. And you see what I mean? Is that me tweeting? I think it was.
Notifications are notifications.
Tweet deck. It's not on the list. Has to turn it off. So I think it's a... It's not an easy thing to do. And I went to a comprehensive school and no one... I mean, you know, so teachers went on strike when I was 14 and it was the end of extracurricular sports. So I never played a competitive match again for the rest of my school career.
Really? Wow.
No one really cared for my education. My parents were, I was the first to do a degree in my immediate family. My father was very proud, but I just kind of got there through, you know, on the skin of my teeth. I didn't really care about my education, didn't care about my exams. I just did what, when the pressure ramped up, I did my work, but usually just the night before an exam, sort of thing. And I would do my homework so I wouldn't get into trouble, not because I was bothered about my education. What I do remember about school are things like standing on the desk reciting Friends, Roman Countrymen. I remember things like that, you know, extraordinary stories about the geography teacher would tell about when he taught in Africa. And other things. I remember doing funny business kind of days, you know, where you had to run a business and do negotiations and like run business meetings and manufacture things.
Yeah, and I think that's fair enough. And I think, you know, we do need memorable stuff. But the thing is, if you had an amazing, amazing education where every day were you doing fantastic stuff, you wouldn't be able to remember every day anyway, even if you were doing fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
So there has to be an element of the mundane. But at the same time, I'm definitely with you in terms of you remember the stuff that you did differently.
Yeah, well, that was just natural, isn't it? Of course, of course I did. And I remember doing the things that I was good at, I guess, you know, which was larking about and being silly, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I'm trying to wonder. So somewhere I developed my brain, but I really don't know where it was. So it wasn't. It certainly wasn't at school, though. I mean, certainly not in that way.
But part of it's genetic. I certainly would not be someone who says that all of intelligence is genetic and handed down. But I did read something. I'll not be able to find it again quickly. But was saying basically that, and I've only done science to a pretty low level, but basically because of the way that chromosomes and DNA and stuff works, most of what determines a child's genetic intelligence comes from its mother, which would certainly make sense in my household.
Mine too.
Which is interesting, because back in times, pre-scientific times, men thought that women were just the soil in which the seed grew. So, just goes to show it's exactly the opposite.
I think the soil is quite important, though. It feeds all your nutrients, where your roots go down, all of that kind of stuff, you know. Cool. Okay. So we're going to reject meritocracy as a model or an aspirational model or whatever or a framework upon which to build or grow up.
Yes. So my final paragraph in this article is quote. As a parent with an embarrassment of almost worthless degree certificates to my name, I owe it to my children and those everywhere to help build a better non-meritocratic system. Let's raise all the boats in the harbour rather than focus on those that are already shiny and seaworthy. End of quote.
And what do you mean by raising all the boats in the harbour?
Well, like Stephen Downes said when he was talking about class, he was saying that the only thing that makes sense is for you to rise with your class. Otherwise, you feel guilt, you feel like you're out of place in society, you don't know where your roots are, etc. The whole point is that you should be trying to raise the lot and the expectations and the condition of everybody who was like you growing up, rather than, you know, trying to be plucked like some kind of toy grabbing machine, you know, in the sleazy circus playground of life.
I think there is if you got somebody who's in favor of grammar schools around the table, they'd say that people who are in the modern schools would be able to would have a more appropriate education that would fit them better for life. So actually that they would get a better. So if you put them in a school that was, if you take out those top grade nonsense or whatever it is that those grammar schools do, that academic stuff, all those books or whatever, and you have your modern school, which is more sort of vocational based and focuses on trade and all that kind of thing, rather than going up towards degrees, undergraduate degrees. And that's surely what you're doing, is you're raising the bar for those children in the modern school as well. Kind of thing, because you're focusing them into
it. You're literally putting some kids in a different school, and the filter by which you are making you're deciding to do that is a purely academic one, and you're affecting the life chances of those children based on a test that they are taking one day when they're 11 years old.
I think so, but I'm just going to quote your own paragraph back at you. Can I do that?
Of course.
An embarrassment of almost worthless degree certificates. That's what you have. Okay.
Mm.
So what you're saying, really. So I know lots of people who you know, lots of children who I'm now friends with on Facebook, and I taught 20 years ago or whatever, and they've got trades and they're making a decent living, and some of them are making a very good living because they had more than a trade. They had an inkling to be entrepreneurial, and they coordinate their business in that trade, and they might be plumbers, they might be whatever, and that's that. And that's potentially them marking out a good life for themselves. That's not a bad thing. But I know a lot of people who go into academia and get these worthless degree certificates, you've got these people who are depressed at Oxford University who either teach there or went there or whatever it was. Who's got it right? Who's got it wrong? Really? I mean, is it just society saying that actually this push towards grammar schools is that we just perceive that as that is the good thing? Do you know what I mean? The grammar school is the thing that everybody wants, but only some can get, when actually that might not be the path to a good life, and that those on a path
exactly
to a good
right.
life.
So when you've only got a single measure of something, so let's take GDP as a measure of a flourishing society. So really the only way in which there are kind of smaller studies to do with happiness of people and nations, but really the way that countries are compared is through their GDP, their gross domestic product, which assumes that economies can keep on growing forever, which has been critiqued by not even just the people, economists on the left. So you've got a very narrow measure. So politicians have to make this number go up. And it's the same when it comes to schooling. So whether it's raw GCSE scores, whether it's value added, whether it's progress rate, whatever it's going to be, that number has to go up. When you've got a multitude of measures, when you've got a measure which is perhaps less academic, or maybe it's less privileging a certain type of child, then surely that's better for society. Because you, as you were talking there, used the word good life, but that is always assumed to be earning more money than other people. You know,
that's what I'm saying, though. No, it's that assumption that I'm talking about. That assumption is that we're assuming that the grammar school is the step to the good life, whereas I'm just proffering the idea that middle school, I mean, some modern school, the alternative to grammar, it might be actually the better road to a good life. Potentially. I'm just saying that. I mean, you know, there's certainly nothing I've mixed in all kinds of places in society, you know, different groups of people. And because of my background, because of where I come from, where I've taught, etc. And I don't see any particular recipe for what makes a good life. Every school I've ever worked in, I have been shocked at the circumstances that the set of cards that children have been dealt with to play in unique, you know, in individual circumstances, that they've had a very, very tough time of it. And that's the same here at Arundel School as it was at Hurlingham and Chelsea School, and which was the toughest school I've probably worked in. And yeah, I don't know. It's a difficult thing. But I'm just wondering of whether it's society's perception of what makes a good life that is really at fault, and that people just think that it's consumer culture stuff, that it's having more, having bigger, having more than one house, having your choice of all the range of cars and televisions and such like, going on the best holidays to the most beautiful places.
Well, someone has to. I mean, it's not. I mean, now is a perfect example of it not really being society which is choosing what counts. So we've got a new government in place which we didn't vote for. Like, every part of the government is different. So the Prime Minister is different. We've got, it's the same political party, but every single part of the government is different. And we've also got, after 52% of people voted for Brexit, we've got a hard Brexit happening. As someone mentioned on Twitter today, if it had been the opposite way around, if we'd had 52% of people voting, you know, to stay in Europe, would we have had multilingual signs, Schengen agreement, you know, people going overboard in terms of the EU side of things? No, we wouldn't. So why are we all of a sudden getting this hard Brexit idea? And so what you've got is this very new approach to politics and this new approach to the NHS, society, all this kind of stuff coming in. And it's not really something that society, in inverted commas, has decided to do. It's something which is pretty much being imposed upon us off the flimsiest mandate, really.
Yes, it's true. But that's the way it is. I mean, the cookie has to crumble one way or the other, I guess.
So I guess what I'm saying is it's not really a bottom-up consensus here. It's real politique, and it's people seizing upon what's perceived to be the zeitgeist to drive through pretty ideological things such as grammar schools. Because the Conservatives have wanted to do grammar schools for years, and it was only the misgivings of David Cameron which stopped this happening earlier. And now, basically on the back of, oh well, the people have voted. Yeah, we voted on something very vague and to do with Europe, and all of a sudden all sorts of stuff is being driven through off the back of, you know, the people have spoken. Anyway,
I think we should wrap that up and do, we've meritocratized ourselves into
oblivion.
Indeed. So we've got miscellaneous section to go. That was good. I enjoyed talking about that, but I'm just conscious that we're going to go around in circles.
Well, apologies for those listening. If you know, feel free to. Oh, by this point, you should have fast-forwarded already. But it's interesting, and if you've got any thoughts on this, we'd love to hear them. The miscellaneous section does have three links on badge-related stuff and one on browsers, Google Chrome alternatives. Where do you want to start?
Well, something badgy, I think.
I wrote something this week, and
let's just do them in order. Go on.
Okay, I wrote something this week, and this one is entitled Three Things We Need for the Next Big Frontier in Open Badges and Digital Credentials. So anytime you put a number at the start of a blog post and you use the word like big or anything like that, then people share your blog post, and that's what happened this week. Basically what I'm trying to say in this blog post is that it's all very well having badges and all this kind of stuff, but the thing we haven't really solved on the web is identity at a distance. And what I mean by that is, how do you show a much more holistic version of who you are, or versions of who you are, because we're multifaceted and we have many identities. How do you do that at a distance? And badges are very much in the early days of being able to do that kind of stuff. So three things that I suggested that we might need are progression pathways. How do we show that we've leveled up in some kind of way and followed some kind of path towards things, not just the path which society expects us to do, but ones which are available to us, and how can we show other people the path that we've taken. It's always very instructive, I think, to look at people's, even just people's LinkedIn profiles, for people who are either in positions that you'd like to be in or in a similar position to yourself, because what you find out is that people don't have straight pathways ever. I think we need to foreground that a bit more. The second thing I think we need are granular permissions, especially when it comes to badge evidence. So you can display your badges publicly, but if the evidence behind your badge is sensitive, if it's something which you don't really want to share with the whole world, then we need more granular permissions around that, in the same way you can do with like Google Docs and stuff. So I think there's a business opportunity there. And then the third one is kind of related, which is long-term storage. Some vendors, some organizations will go out of business, and we need to make sure that badges work in for the long term, and that they have some kind of deep freeze and storage. There's Amazon Glacier. I know there were talks with the Internet Archive when I was at Mozilla. So I think that all of this, if we have that long-term storage, if we have granular permissions, if we have pathways, then we're getting towards being able to have badge-based identity on the web, which is a good thing, I think.
This all makes sense. They're three quite straightforward things that make sense. And it's a difficult thing because you need, as you talk about, you need a non-profit to like really bring this together in the interests of providing the platform and kind of give it away like Tim Berners-Lee did with HTTP, HTML.
Yeah, and I'm going to do a bit of work, actually. I'm going to write, I think it still needs to be finalized, but I'm going to write three blog posts for Concentric Sky, who have an open source platform called Badger, which the director of the Badger Alliance, Nate Otto, works on. And they have developed a new open standard which works in tandem with the Open Badges infrastructure called Open Pathways. And the idea is that it's an interoperable way of describing credential-based pathways that people can go through towards employment or, you know, have self-directed learning or whatever it is. So it's a much more visual way of explaining how people level up in their knowledge, skills, and understanding.
Cool. That'll be interesting.
One of the things which prompted my post, you know, what I'm very much of the opinion that things coalesce together based on multiple inputs, which is why I think it's ridiculous that people claim ownership over ideas. I think that there's nothing new under the sun. And one of the things which fed into the pot was this post by Mark Lesser. Mark is a senior director of learning design at Mouse, which is an organization in the US that works on STEM and digital literacies and that kind of stuff. And he was very helpful when I was working on the web literacy map at Mozilla. So he has written a post on Medium called Improving the Way Education Supports Learner Identity, with the subtitle being Digital Badges in the Information Age. And he tells a story. Yep. And he tells the difference between the industrial age and the information age. And I guess his point is that he says that we need to kind of figure out, it's a long burn, it's a long, slow burn with badges. He says, quote, and he quotes a learner who's earned badges through Mouse, and he says, digital credentials are not a panacea, but they deserve the patience, rigor, and persistence that innovation requires. End of quote. And this person that Mark himself quotes says that receiving digital badges through Mouse is what helped me to create my digital footprint. Recognizing the skills and accomplishments that I have developed with digital badges has validated these skills, which was especially important when I started applying to colleges and summer internships. End of quote.
Oh, okay. I think that's, I mean, I did talk about last week that my pupil has applied to Cambridge, my tutee has applied to Cambridge to do architecture, and that he has put a link to a portfolio that he built on Wix. I did talk about that, didn't I?
Yes, you did, yeah.
And that's not badging, but it is badging in a way. If anyone is to believe that he actually did that, but it's the same sort of thing. It's a pathway. It's evidence of ability and such like. I don't know.
As we've said before, you know, the original attempt at doing something like this was e-portfolios, but nobody's got time to sift through unstructured e-portfolios. So I guess badges, because they're structured metadata, allow a way in which you can search through lots of badges, especially with version 2 of the specification. Like you'll see badges popping up in Google searches and all sorts. There's a way in which you can sift through the metadata. You can really find people who haven't even applied for the job, maybe, and think would be a fantastic fit. So there's all different ways in which we can do things related to identity and searching, and use both the humanity of badges, but also the technical side of them as well. And the third badges link is something, so I'm linking to my own post here, but only because it links out to several other places. So when I was at Mozilla, one of the things I really tried to do was to merge the two things I'd been working on, which were web literacy and badges. And it was, you'd think it would be such an easy thing to do, but it was difficult because it was very difficult to get traction from developers. There wasn't particularly funding available for that, etc., etc. And as I say in the post, it might have been my own... Do I say this in the post or did I delete that bit? It might have been just my own failings and my lack of ability to gain traction. But lo and behold, and I'm delighted now, there are now, what, 5, 10, 14 different badges for all of the different competencies of version 2 of the Web Literacy Map. Now, this has come from several sources. This has come because of Bill and Melinda Gates' funding. This has come from Digital Me having a contract and agreement with Mozilla to do work on the Mozilla Badge Backpack, but also on things like badge systems, which they can put into the Open Badge Passport. But the great thing about this DAO, which is exactly what was needed, is that instead of this being a badge system which only exists on a single Open Badges platform, i.e. Open Badge Academy, it's been put into a GitHub repository, and it will exist. I don't think it exists on there yet, but it will exist on Credly as well as on Open Badge Academy. Yeah. And it can just be taken and put on any badges platform. The idea is that this is something which is, you can spin it up and can be replicated however many times you want. So you can imagine not just there being web literacy badges that you could put on any platform you want, but there could be employability badges or whatever you want. That's a great, great idea. Wonderful. It's openness through and through.
No, it's an important step, isn't it? That somebody is appreciating, and I guess it's Digital Me, and possibly something to do with your influence, that that they're actually creating a system which will spread across the different platforms.
Well, I mean, Matt Rogers from Digital Me, he has written a post called A Journey into the Open, and he, you know, talks quite openly about him having his own thinking challenged about how open a system can be. Even when it's based on an open metadata standard, you can still open it even further. So it's great, and I'm delighted that this has happened.
Good. Yes, no, I think this is a big deal.
So, yeah, it's worth mentioning to people as well, given the timing of this particular podcast, that the Mozilla Festival is at the end of this month. The We Are Open team is running 3 sessions there. If you've never been before, it will blow your mind. And you should go along. Tickets are about £50 at mozillafestival.org. So do come along, and I will see you there.
Sounds like fun. How could I not go? Okay, 7 alternatives to Google Chrome. Is any one of them good enough?
Well, things which aren't on there, Firefox, Safari, and Microsoft Internet Explorer or Edge. The ones that are on there, there's Blisk browser, there's Tor browser, Aloha, Vivaldi, Opera, Min, Ghost. Yeah, they're the 7 browsers. Have you tried any of these?
No, I'm familiar with Opera because it's a VPN for iOS, which means that it's something we have to deal with. Aloha, I think I've used an Opera I used to use back in the day, but not as a VPN before I did that. But other than that, no, I don't know any of them.
So I'm disappointed Brave isn't on here, because I think Brave, which has been founded by Brendan Eich, former CEO of Mozilla, it's trying to solve the issue of advertising on the web. So have a look at that Brave browser. It's not on this list. I've used Tor browser. I use on my Android device. And the other ones I hadn't really heard of. I've heard of Vivaldi because you can... I think the whole thing is built on web technology, so you can hack the browser using your knowledge of how to build websites and stuff, which is very meta. Min looks great, although I haven't tried it yet. The idea is, you know, we were talking about the smart search bar earlier. It allows you to answer questions in the search bar without having to actually press enter and do the search. So for the example it gives is, you type in, it was a dark and stormy night, and in very small writing underneath, it says, it was a dark and stormy night is an often mocked and parodied phrase written by English novelist Edward Bulwer Lytton.
That's like Google auto search or auto complete, isn't it?
On steroids, yeah.
Absolutely. On steroids, yeah. And that does look good because I think that is much more, it's a much more the mobile experience. And I've been thinking about this as life moves towards mobile, which I still think it's doing. I still think the mobile market is increasing, even though the hardware market is saturated. The actual usage market seems to be increasing to me. And that's much more kind of mobile functionality, much more sensible. It's like, okay, I'm typing something out and it's going to give me the suggestion of what it thinks is going on before I press enter and commit, kind of thing. And that's quite often what you need, what you want from a web search, is just some quick information fed back to you.
Yeah, and as long as you trust the thing which is giving you the information, it's all good.
Yes, of course.
Mm. This week I managed to, at the same time, managed to render both my laptops inoperable, which on my Chromebook Pixel is never really a problem because you press a couple of buttons and it just restarts and you put in your Google account and it reloads everything, so that's fine. But my Linux laptop, which was running elementary OS, I knew it was going to take a while to fix. I didn't really have anything which I hadn't backed up on there already, so I decided to try a different Linux distribution. And given that I spend a lot of my time in Chrome OS, just because it's so lightweight and almost everything I do is, apart from this podcast actually, is in the browser, I decided to put a distribution of Linux on called Kub Linux. Now, this might be of real interest to anybody who works in an institution or organization like yourself, Dai, who wants something which might prolong the life of, say, an old laptop, Windows machine, or whatever, and especially if that organization already uses Google Apps. So this advertises itself as the Chromium OS, which is the open source version of the Chrome OS project, plus Ubuntu equals Kub. So Chromium plus Ubuntu equals Kub. So it's using the long-term support version of Ubuntu 14.04, and then it skins it and it makes it look like, and it takes some of the elements from Chromium OS, so it looks and feels like a slightly less shiny version of Chrome OS. And you've got all of the bookmark bars along the bottom, like Chrome and Gmail and YouTube and Google Drive and all that kind of stuff. And it's just very, very easy to use. But the great thing is, if you right-click on the desktop, you can install other applications as well. You can install graphic packages, you can install Audacity, so it has the best of both worlds. And so I've been messing about with that this week.
Cool. So as I look at my the apps that I have open that I use on a daily basis, all of them are web-based potentially, and except for screencasting software and video editing software and GIMP, all of which would be on that. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to play with that. I like the look of it because it just serves many, many needs. And if you can have Linux, you can have, I can have all the tools that I need, I think.
One of the things which the geekier people listening will appreciate is that something that Microsoft managed, so there's something called UEFI in Secure Boot, which try and make sure that your machine is hack-proof, which is a good thing, but also it has in the past made installing open source things like Linux on your device problematic, because it would try and lock it down and lock down the bootloader and all that kind of stuff. So the good thing is that Kub Linux is not only available in 32 and 64-bit editions, but it is compatible with UEFI and Secure Boot. So if you know what that means, that is a good thing. Yes, excellent.
Mm. Cool. Brilliant. Well, that was fun.
Mm. What are you up to this coming week, Dai?
This coming week, well, for me, it's half term starts on Saturday. So I teach Saturday morning, and then it's half term for 2 weeks, which is very, very nice. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I need it, to be honest. It's tough work being in the boarding house all of the time because you just do more stuff, basically, because you're here. So I'll be looking forward to a rest.
Are you going away?
Work. I have my mother is 70 years old on the 23rd, right in the middle, so I will be at my parents' house celebrating on the weekend, and that's it. As far as planned so far, and I kind of just use this holiday for a rest and not to go anywhere. Although lots of teachers do fly off places, because it's because they can, I guess. I don't know.
Get some sun.
Yeah, although the weather here has been beautiful. I mean, it's chillier, but the lights and the sun have been out and it's beautiful. Mm. So I'm not worried about that yet. By Christmas, I will be. and so I can't remember the work that I'm doing. I've got lots of stuff going on and planning to be done for different projects and things like that. How about you? What are you up to?
I am mainly writing this week. I've got a birthday cake to bake for my wife tomorrow, which, if you knew my baking/cooking history, would certainly raise a smile. So we'll see how that goes. It's her birthday on Friday. She is 6-7 weeks older than me, which I never let her forget. But I'm writing quite a lot.
Have you never thought of it? So you're going to bake the cake. Is that so that it's like got that personal touch?
Yes. You know, like, she works on a Wednesday at a primary school, so it's a perfect opportunity for me to do that.
And is it not for you to go down to the shops and buy a really nice cake?
She would know. She'd know.
No, okay. Just saying.
So I'm doing a lot of writing this week. I've got a critical friend call. I'm catching up with the director of the Badger Alliance. I'm hopefully setting dates to go to Jersey. They've been quite slow getting back to me. And just doing the old business development, MozFest planning, that kind of stuff. Yep. Doing some more chapters of the audiobook as well.
Okay, yes. Excellent. Well, I hope you have a very good week.
You too. I'll talk to you next week when you're on holiday.
Yes. Have a good week, everyone. I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.